It was on October the 21st, 1966, that it happened. There had been accidents before, of course. Coal mining is a notoriously dangerous industry. But this accident was different. For it happened not deep underground, out of the sight of press and television. It happened in the clear light of day, before the eyes of the nation. And it happened not to miners themselves, tough, resilient, hardened men who know the peril of the pit and choose to risk it voluntarily. No, tragically, this accident happened to the miners' children. Abba Farm was the name of the place. A typical, if very obscure, South Wales mining community, nestling in the valley of the River Taff, just a few miles from Merthyr Tydfil. On its outskirts stood a man-made hillock some 200 feet high. Over 1 million tons of accumulated coal slag had been dumped on that hill during some 8 years of coal mining at the nearby Merthyr Vale Colliery. It was just after 9 a.m. on that fateful Friday morning in October when the mountain began to move. Slowly at first, by such imperceptible degrees, those working cranes on the top of it didn't realize what was happening. And then all of a sudden, an avalanche of black sludge descended upon the village. Cottages and shops were engulfed, but it was not their loss that was responsible for this being such a heart-rending and horrifying calamity. No. Pantglass Junior School stood at the very foot of the mountain. 254 young children had registered that Friday morning for lessons. The tidal wave of mud swallowed them whole. Two-thirds of those children perished in its suffocating morass. Many of you will know that evangelical religion is very strong in South Wales. There was a revival there in 1905. Many of the residents of Aberfan would have been in chapel the previous Sunday. Indeed, the Baptist pastor's child was at that school. I remember very vividly a TV report which interviewed him. They showed him in the church hall, which had become a temporary mortuary. Row upon row of little wrapped corpses were laid out in it. Grief-stricken faces of parents seeking to identify their children, walking up and down. "My faith has been shaken to the core," the pastor confessed. "I don't know how I shall ever preach again." Can you blame him? What can a Christian say in the face of such a horrifying disaster? Where are you and I to find the spiritual resources to go on believing in the face of suffering on such a scale and of such a kind? The temptation to doubt in those sort of circumstances is almost irresistible, isn't it? For some, like the philosopher Bertrand Russell, it's proved far too irresistible. Such incidents, as he argues in his essay, The Faith of a Rationalist, make it impossible for any sane, rational person to believe in God. But for others, perhaps, who possess some faith, the commonest skepticism which this sort of problem, this problem of suffering fosters, is not so much, I think, doubt about the abstract existence of God as it was for a philosopher like Russell. No, it is doubt concerning God's practical goodness that perhaps most torments us. Does God care? That was the question the weeping mothers were asking in Abber Farm that day. Does God care? It's a question suffering believers have always asked. And I put it to you this evening that there is no question actually of greater interest and importance to us, whether or not we have yet had to face anything approaching an Abafan disaster in our lives. You often hear people say they want religious certainty. We want proof about God, they say. Ironically, the kind of proof we often seek, scientific, philosophical, logical kinds of proof, is not the kind of proof that really addresses our deepest anxieties where God is concerned, is it? I mean, just supposing, for the sake of argument, we could prove beyond reasonable doubt that in some remote and isolated heavenly realm there is an ultimate answer, a meaning to this universe, a first cause. Would that constitute any real answer to the spiritual hunger in your heart? I suggest to you it would not. No, for the assurance we yearn for is not to know simply that God exists, but that he cares for us, insignificant specks though we must appear as he looks at us down his cosmic microscope. A faith in a God who doesn't care, well, it might suffice to make us fatalists. It may suffice to make us hedonists. A faith in a God who doesn't care might foster in us the stiff upper lip of a Stoic, or the self-indulgent escapism of one of the lotus eaters. But of one thing I am sure, if God doesn't care, neither will we. Callous indifference is all that is left to us in a world where nature, red in tooth and claw, shrieks its denial of anybody who dares to claim that God is love. Now I put it to you that when you're up to your waist in coal slag, clawing at the mud in a desperate race to find some precious child before their breath is squeezed from their body terminally, it is not the question of whether God abstractly exists or not that matters to you. Such a question is almost laughable by its academic ivory tower irrelevance. Does God care? That's what matters to you in situations like that. Is he here with us? Working with us? Weeping with us? Because if he is not, we perish without hope or consolation, whether he exists or not. If you multiply the Abafan disaster by 100,000 or two, you're getting pretty close to the scale of the crisis which affect the people of Israel 5 centuries before Christ. You have to picture a people who have been taught for hundreds of years, 1,000 years or more, that they are the chosen people of God. God has given them their land. He has given them a king. He has given them their temple. He has done so by an irrevocable, unchangeable covenant, a promise. Nothing whatsoever will take these things from them. That is what they have been taught for 10 centuries. Now picture this same people, besieged for 2 long, harrowing years by a heathen army, the Babylonian army. Picture them reduced to abject starvation, mothers consuming their own children in the desperation of their hunger. Picture them finally defeated, humiliated by the overpowering military might of this pagan empire. Imagine them being forcibly driven into exile, into a foreign land, knowing that their own beloved and beautiful city has been left nothing more than a deserted ghost town. It's quite impossible, you see, to overestimate the shattering effect that national tragedy had on the faith of the Jewish people. Their temple was in ruins. Their king was a prisoner. Their land a desolation under foreign occupation. And they now were exiles in a country where other gods were worshipped. Idols who seemed more able to bring prosperity and victory than their own Jehovah could. The temptation to apostasy was enormous. Even formerly pious believers were shaking their heads and saying, God doesn't care. He can't care. How can a God who cares do this to us, his own people? It was a major spiritual crisis. The faith of the whole nation hung in the balance. Under similar pressure, many other nations and their religions had simply capitulated. Their creeds abandoned as outdated and irrelevant, supplanted by the new and trendy philosophies of this conquering culture. Perhaps the greatest miracle the Old Testament records is this. That as a matter of historical fact, Israel did not succumb to that temptation. The faith of Israel survived. If Israel's exodus from Egypt is the Old Testament corollary of Christian salvation, I reckon Israel's survival of the exile has to be the Old Testament parallel to the resurrection. The dead bones of a decimated nation revived and stood on their feet. And who was the architect of this remarkable national regeneration? Under God, it was the prophets, a handful of them, and none more important than the one who wrote the chapters we're going to be studying over these next four Sunday nights. The author of these chapters of Isaiah from 40 onwards. I put it in that way because, as some of you are no doubt familiar with, there is a debate about who wrote the second half of Isaiah's book. Some argue it was Isaiah himself, but we know he lived three centuries before the exile. And it is unusual, to say the least, for an Old Testament prophet to preach to any other audience than his own contemporaries. So many scholars feel that this must be the work of some anonymous later prophet, whose words have been incorporated into the book of Isaiah. I can't honestly say it matters hugely to me. What is clear is that from chapter 40 onwards, in this great book of Isaiah, it is that desperate exilic situation that is being addressed. A people whose faith has been strained to breaking point. And because of that, this is a section of the Bible that speaks with no less relevance to suffering believers in every age and in whatever circumstance. Its message is really quite simple. No matter how the ravages of pain and destruction and death may tempt you to doubt it, this God cares. He does care. See how this chapter 40 begins, setting that message right on the agenda from the very outset. Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and proclaim to her that her hard service has been completed, that her sin has been paid for, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. There's no way, you see, the prophet can minimize the suffering that God's people had experienced. Like slaves engaged in forced labor for a cruel tyrant, they have endured, as he calls it, hard service in verse 2. But his message is this: don't despair. For those long years of duress are coming to an end. You must not imagine any longer that God is bellowing at you in his wrath. No, now, like some young Romeo whispering in the ear of his beloved, he is speaking tenderly to you. And what's he saying? Comfort. Comfort, my people. That double repetition adds emotional intensity to the voice of God. The day of your hard service are completed. The sin which demanded such judgment has been dealt with. You have received from the Lord's hand double for all your sins, he says. Some commentators say that means that Israel had suffered so much it was out of proportion to her sins, that she had so to speak paid off the debt herself and more than paid it off. But I don't think that's what Isaiah is saying at all. I think what the prophet is saying rather is that God has a plan in mind, a great act of atonement, of which Isaiah himself will speak later in his book. And it is more than sufficient to pay the moral debt of God's people once and for all. Listen, says the prophet. Can't you hear the voice of God's herald even now? Already he's summoning angelic servants to lay out the red carpet for the Saviour's arrival. Make a flat road for his royal chariot, he orders. Make straight in the wilderness a highway for our God. Every valley shall be raised up and every mountain and hill made low. The rough ground shall become level, the rugged places plain. For God is coming. Coming with speed and with glory. And all mankind will see it. You will tell me that in your present situation it's very difficult to expect such things. Hallelujah doesn't come easily to the lips of a people who've suffered 70 years hard labor in foreign exile. But, says the prophet, hard though it is to believe it, I want you to. For though it's true that we human beings are such ephemeral creatures, and when the wrath of God blows on us, we wither away, there is one thing that is immune from the ravages of time, that suffers no seasonal ups and downs. And that's God's word. That's what I'm asking you to put your faith in, says the prophet. The word of the Lord, verse 8, stands forever. And it is by that word that I declare to you God's imminent coming. Quick, send the town crier up to the top of the nearest mountain with a megaphone in his hand, he says. Tell him to shout the good news to all the towns and villages around Jerusalem. Lift up your voice. Do not be afraid. Say to the towns of Judah, here is your God. See, the sovereign Lord comes with power and his arm rules for him. See, his reward is with him and his recompense accompanies him. He tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms and carries them close to his heart. He gently leads those that have young. This God then comes not as a vicious destroyer, but as a tender and as a loving shepherd of his people. This is a God who cares desperately, and who plans soon to set up an invincible messianic kingdom of love and share it with you to show you just how much he cares. Can you believe it? That was the question, of course. That was the question for the prophet's hearers. Could they believe such a message of hope after 70 years of misery? Hadn't it wiped out any faith that could respond to such a word of hope? How could he persuade them that they must believe it? P.T. Forsyth, writing an important book in the midst of the First World War about pain and suffering, says, it is an immensely courageous thing in confrontation with this proud, demonic world to say you believe in the goodness of God. It was just such courage this people needed to discover in the midst of their 5th century BC Holocaust. And what our prophet discerns by the inspiration of God's Spirit is that only the most lofty theology of God could make such a courageous faith even conceivable. That's why he goes on as he does in verse 12. See, some people try to retain faith in the goodness of God during tragic times by blaming it all on the devil. You must have heard this. It's not God's fault, they say, that these things happen. God's doing his best, poor fella, but this world lies in the power of Satan. And there's a limit, therefore, to what poor God can do. Others, in a rather similar way, try to defend God's goodness by blaming it all on man, the so-called free will defense. God doesn't want these things to happen, you know. He's given man free will, that's all. And sin must be punished, so bad things happen. It's all retribution, really. If you read John Stuart Mill's famous essay on nature, it's precisely this line he more or less is driven to take. Unwilling, he says, to doubt God's goodness, we must therefore question his omnipotence. For how can we possibly believe that an almighty God will sit around with his arms folded in a world of such misery as ours? There must be a limit on God's power if he lets a world like ours continue and does nothing about it. The trouble with those approaches, of course, is not that they're totally wrong. There is an element of truth in what they're saying. There is a devil, and it is a mistake to underestimate his malevolence. A man is a sinner, and God's wrath does fall on this world because of our sin in all kinds of judgment. The Bible says as much. But the trouble, of course, with that kind of answer to the problem of tragedy and suffering in our world is that there's no comfort in it. Such views rationalize tragedy without providing any real basis for hope. After all, if God is the helpless pawn of satanic wiles or of human free will, if things like Abba Farn or the exile can happen without God being able to do anything about it, what sort of God is he? A God who has to fold his arms while the force of evil wreaks all kinds of havoc in his world is hardly the sort of God you can trust. Where do we look for comfort on such a view? No, our prophet will tell us there is no comfort in such a theology. The message he gives to poor, disillusioned Israel is precisely that. Comfort is not to be found by denying God's control over our human affairs, by finding some alternative explanation that doesn't implicate him. Rather, comfort comes by a massive reassertion of his unrivaled sovereignty over absolutely everything. That's the only way to discover hope and faith in the face of an Abba Farn disaster, of a Babylonian exile. He doesn't try to excuse God, then, of the responsibility of the exile in order to defend Israel's faith. Rather, he assures Israel, tragic though her situation is, even the exile makes sense in the mysterious and vast counsels of this everlasting and almighty Creator God. His remedy for Israel's spiritual crisis is not to paint God smaller, but to paint him in all his gigantic magnitude. Behold your God. Some of you may remember years ago in the 50s, J.B. Phillips wrote a little book entitled Your God is Too Small. It's a good subtitle for Isaiah 40. There are few chapters in the Bible that exult in the sheer greatness of God quite so triumphantly. Do you notice that rhetorical question he asks twice? First in verse 18, and then again in verse 25. To whom then will you compare God? Verse 25, more personally, to whom will you compare me, or who is my equal, says the Holy One. As you scan through the chapter, it's clear the prophet looks just about everywhere for an answer to that rhetorical question. He looks to the equivalent of scientists and technologists, first of all, in verse 12. Geologists and astronomers and civil engineers and theoretical physicists. We're so proud, aren't we, of our mastery of the universe. We can measure it and control it, harness its energies. What wonderfully powerful creatures we human beings are. Would anybody like to try their hand at relocating the Pacific Ocean? Asks the prophet. Or redistributing the Sahara Desert, perhaps. Maybe somebody would like to knock down the Himalayas. God can. We boast of our hope to have a fusion reactor soon. But it is God who made those vast nuclear forces that give cohesion to our universe. He made them. There is no power that human beings can wield that can possibly compare to his, no matter how our science and technology develops. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, or with the breadth of his hand marked off the heavens? Who has held the dust of the earth in a basket, or weighed the mountains on the scales and the hills in a balance? The prophet moves on to make similar demands of the clever, the intelligent, the wise. Who hath understood the Spirit of the Lord, or instructed him as his counselor, he asks? Whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him? Who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge, or showed him the path of understanding? You must have noticed how these days consultative services are blossoming everywhere. You can't go anywhere without professional advice. You can't do anything without professional advice. Business consultants, investment consultants, advertising consultants, computer consultants, architectural consultants, legal consultants. It's all a conspiracy, really, isn't it? What firm of consultants does God use? Asks the prophet. Whose advice does he apply for to help him in his projects? Does he have to go to the University of Cambridge to get a degree in law before he can exercise jurisprudence in his world? No, he says, nobody ever taught God. He is omniscient. Even the great Albert Einstein, you know, once confessed, "I feel like a man chained. If only I could be freed from my intellectual smallness." Can you imagine that? Albert Einstein, intellectually small. But he was. He was. Isaac Newton, the only man perhaps in Western history who parallels his genius in physics, once compared himself to a little boy standing on the edge of a huge ocean of truth, picking up the occasional pebble to admire, while the ocean lay undiscovered in front of him. But no such finitude limits God. He knows and understands everything. No human wisdom can possibly compare with his. So the prophet moves on to the international arena, the political empires of men with their massive military stockpiles and their buoyant economies and their vast domains. Empires like that of Babylon that had just conquered Israel. Surely among the imperialists of the Old Testament we will find something that can rival God. But no, verse 15. The nations are like a drop in a bucket. They are regarded as dust on the scales. He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust. Lebanon is not sufficient for altar fires, nor its animals enough for burnt offerings, he says. Great nations for God are the sort of thing it's easy to overlook, says the prophet. Like those few drops of water left at the bottom of the kettle. Like that dust on the scales in the market that nobody really bothers about, as if it's going to upset the balance. All the wealth of the world cannot enrich him. The entire livestock of the Middle East would be an inadequate offering for him. What we call superpowers, do you know what he calls them? Nothings. Non-entities. Before him, all the nations are as nothing. They are regarded by him as worthless, as less than nothing. He simply belongs to a different order of magnitude, you see. No world power can compare with him. Why then, let's turn for inspiration to other religions. What about the deities of Babylon, for instance? Surely they must be able to rival the Lord. That's says Isaiah, you've only got to describe a pagan deity to see how pathetic it is in comparison to the God of Bible religion. As for an idol, verse 19, a craftsman casts it, and a goldsmith overlays it with gold and fashions silver chains for it. A man too poor to present such an offering selects wood that will not rot. He looks for a skilled craftsman to set up an idol that will not topple. You see the mockery, the irony in this. How can an artifact of metal, no matter how precious, says the prophet, possibly represent God the Creator? It's an insult to him. Why, such an idol lacks the most characteristic of God of all. It's lifeless. You have to make chains for it to stop it falling over. You have to pin it to the wall. You have to be careful what wood you make it out of. It's going to rot before you do. How can anything that dead possibly be compared to the vibrant, dynamic God who made life itself? Well, then, let's look at mighty men. Let's look at the heroes of the ancient world, for they were always close to godlike. Can't we find among the potentates and the generals and the conquerors of the ancient world, the Nebuchadnezzars, for instance, the great emperor of Babylon, is he not a little bit godlike? He demands that people prostrate themselves before him in worship, after all. But no, that won't do either, says the prophet. Don't you know, he says? Have you not heard? Hasn't it been told you from the beginning? Haven't you understood since the earth was founded? God sits enthroned above the circle of the whole earth. Its people are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy and spreads them out like a tent to live in. He brings princes to naught and reduces the rulers of this world to nothing. No sooner are they planted, no sooner are they sown, no sooner do they take root in the ground, than he blows on them and they wither. And a whirlwind sweeps them away like chaff. There is no potentate of the earth can compare with this. God's throne fills the universe. He needs no capital city, for the whole of the heavens is his palace. Human despots, in their pretentious arrogance, why, he has only to blow at them, and they wither away, says the prophet. Like a tempest ripping out a seedling sapling that has just taken root. So God can dispense with tyrants. They simply don't compare with him. All right then, one more try. Let's look at the universe. Let's look at the stars. Oh, surely we're getting somewhere now. In the vastness of space, here surely is power, here is wisdom, here is glory, far beyond human comprehension. Do you ever go out and look at the stars? It's a sad fact, I think, of our prosaic 20th century that stargazing is an occupation usually reserved for romantic lovers and lunatic professors. It's a pity, because the stars are extraordinarily humbling as a spectacle. Was it Immanuel Kant who said, if the stars only emerged once in a century, then men would believe and tremble? We take them for granted because they're there every night. It's to our shame that familiarity has bred contempt of the majesty of the universe. Now, if you're looking for something that will stretch your mind, look at the stars. The more you find out about them, the more your mind will boggle at them. And yet, in one short phrase, the prophet forces our minds to open up one more stop. Lift up your eyes and look to the heavens, he says. Who created all this? Almost as a PS of his creative work. He made the stars also. That's all Genesis 1 says. Almost like an afterthought. A last dab of the artist's brush. He made the stars also. To whom then will you liken God? This God who every night summons the stars, controls the vast cosmic gravitational fields, molding space and time itself as an arena for his artistry. To whom will you liken such a God? There is nothing. We search the whole universe in vain for one adequate comparison to his divine majesty. All that men worship, their science and technology, their intelligence and wisdom, their military might, their political achievement, even the very stars in the heavens, none can rival him. He is, says the prophet, the incomparable one. And your trouble, Israel, he says, is that you have been so battered by circumstances, you have forgotten it. And because you have forgotten it, you complain. Why do you say, O Jacob, verse 27, and complain, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord. My cause is disregarded by my God. A few years back, an educational magazine did a survey of children's ideas of God. I think I've quoted it before. Some of you will remember. It was a very revealing survey, I think. God is very kind and good and handsome. I think he has a white coat and black hair. That was one little girl's verdict. I think God is a very nice man and is very kind to everyone, said another 8-year-old. Perhaps most revealing of all was this comment from, I think, an 8-year-old boy. I think God is like us. I said, isn't it? God is like us. We live at the end of the 20th century in a culture which no longer has any concept of the incomparable majesty of God. If we think of God at all, he's like us. Martin Luther said of Erasmus, your God is too human, Erasmus. Well, if Erasmus's God was too human, what would he say of ours? We talk about God being our personal friend, but we've lost sight of him as the awesome sovereign of the universe. Not for us a throne high and lifted up before which angels veil their faces. No, God is our heavenly buddy. We favor him with our friendship. We patronize him with our prayers. We dare to say we're worshipping him when most of the time all we're doing is indulging in an orgy of sentimental reverie. Well, of course, that kind of God can be very enjoyable while things are going well. People in an affluent, prosperous society can enjoy worshipping a God like that. But when tragedy strikes, when the angel of destruction touches your nation, your family, you, the bottom drops out of that kind of theology. There is no guts in such a religion. No strength, no comfort. At such times, a pocket-sized God is no good to anybody. I need a big God, don't you? Only a big God can fire my imagination, and only a big God can sustain me when the going gets really tough. Only a God who is big enough to overrule my world when it's falling into chaos around my ears can possibly say to me with any degree of credibility, comfort, comfort. It is just such a God, our prophet proclaims. Here are the people whining, God has let us down, he's forgotten us, he doesn't care. So the prophet portrays to them God in all his incomparable grandeur. And then he simply adds the question, how dare you? How dare you say that such a God has failed you? All who utter such slanders must learn the lesson of Job. I lay my hand on my mouth, said Job. I have uttered things I didn't understand, things too wonderful for me. I despise myself in dust and ashes. There's a famous story told of Dr. Jowett, who was master of Balliol College, Oxford. Once at high table, a woman guest sought to impress him. Dr. Jowett, we would like to know what is your opinion of God, she said. The wise old scholar replied, Madam, I should think it a great impertinence were I to express my opinion of God. The only constant anxiety of my life is to know God's opinion of me. wise words. Well, you see, there can be no proud voices raised, no indignant fists waved, confronted by this infinite Lord. Only the embarrassed silence of small children who have strayed foolishly into the arena of adult conversation, too lofty for their infantile understandings. The trouble with us is, ever since the fall of Adam, we have resented our creatureliness. We don't like to think of ourselves as creatures, subject to a far greater power and person than we are. We like to think of ourselves as God's equals. That's what the devil told us we would be after all. We like to think that God is like us. So we want to argue with him. We want him to consult with us. We want to reduce him to a size we can criticize and evaluate. Turn him into the object of our investigation, of our understanding. But it won't do, you see. This God is too big for our test tubes. That's the whole point. We cannot analyze his purposes or pass verdict on his actions in the way we so often want to. There's an essential impertinence in the very attempt. How dare you complain, says the prophet. How dare you whinge at this God? God is not obliged to give you an answer. He gives us no glib reasons, you see, for the tragic situation of Israel, just as the Bible generally provides no slick answers to the problem of suffering generally. It's humiliating for us human beings, I know, to have to recognize that God is so big he doesn't owe us an answer. But that is the truth. And if it were not the truth, he would not be God. Not a God worth worshipping anyway. Not a God who could possibly help us in those very suffering situations we're complaining about. In the midst of bitter tragedy, only a very big God can bring us comfort. Do you see in these final verses how Isaiah draws out that encouragement, that consolation, which knowing such a great God can bring in times of distress? Because God is so big, he says, you Israelites must realize his purposes cannot fail. Do you not know, verse 28, have you not heard, the Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. Of course, our purposes fail. I may let my friends down for all kinds of reasons. My power is finite. I may want to help them, but not be able to. My wisdom is limited. Unforeseen circumstances may prevent me doing what I want to do for them. But this great and majestic God suffers no such eventualities. His power is inexhaustible. His wisdom is such it's never taken by surprise. He never promises beyond his ability. He's never reduced to contingency plans. No devil defeats him. No human being thwarts him. Devils and men may do precisely what he permits them to do, and no more. Such is the declaration of his word. So no matter how heartbreaking our situation, no matter how perplexing it may seem to our limited understanding, it cannot be out of control. It is in the hands, says the prophet, of a tireless and infinite intelligence who knows what he is doing. Abba found disasters and the like don't mean that God's finger has slipped. And we bring no glory to him by trying to make out that such calamities are outside his control. No. They are not arbitrary and meaningless acts of an impersonal fate. They are permitted sufferings in the world ruled by a sovereign God. That's what they are. No matter how much pain they bring, like the cross itself, where the Son of God suffered. They are tragedies with a meaning. They are tragedies with a purpose. They are tragedies in which this sovereign God is working out his mysterious will for his world. And it is not our duty or place always to understand those purposes. It is our duty and place to trust. And one more thing, says the prophet. because this God is so great, he has power enough to sustain us in our distress. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. Oh yes, God is too big to fail, but he is not too big to care. The greatness of his power is matched exactly by the greatness of his love and compassion. That's why he's able to say comfort. Even in the midst of disaster, he provides his people with the strength they need to endure. And that, of course, is why they do endure. That is why the miracle happened. That is why the faith of God's people endured when superficially far more resilient religions and cultures collapsed under the strain of the Babylonian invasion and countless other imperialist conquests down through the centuries. Young men, even these Babylonian warriors that you are so intimidated by, they will fall exhausted. Virile and competent though they seem, they are but flesh, and all flesh is grass. They and their culture will disappear from the face of the earth and be studied only by archaeologists. But the people of the living God, they never become extinct. The church is no Jurassic Park, you know. They never become extinct. Though often faint and disheartened, they persevere. It's a miracle. Supernatural strength within their souls sustains them, says the prophet. And why? Because they hope in the Lord. Notice that word hope. So much of faith in this broken, sad, tragic world of ours is patience. You know, in maturity, many of us don't recognize that. We think faith is about working miracles of deliverance now. So much of the time it is not. So much of the time the Bible shows us in the history of God's people, faith has been about patience. How does the Apostle Paul say it? Hoping for things that we have seen is not hope at all. Hope is about hoping for things you do not yet have. If you hope in that way, you wait patiently. Why, he says, I do not consider that our sufferings in this present age are worth comparing to the glory that will be revealed. The incongruous events of life only make sense if we're prepared to hope, to wait and see where they fit in. See, like a great composer of music, God sometimes blends discords with his harmonies. If you study those discords in isolation, they will seem horrible, incongruous, jarring to your heart, jarring to your mind, jarring to your faith. But if you set them in the context of the complete symphony, their tragic tones will be found to perfectly complement the dramatic beauty of the whole. You can't judge a symphony of any composer by a single chord. So we must wait. Wait until enough of the melody which God is weaving into human history has flown past us to appreciate where his discords fit in. Sometimes in a limited way, we can do that even now. Looking back over time, you'll often hear people say, I understand it now, I couldn't understand it then. My faith was battered almost to breaking point in the midst of that crisis, but now looking back, I can see what God was doing through it all. If we, from our very limited perspective, can sometimes see that, how much more when we stand on the end of history itself, we understand the grandeur of God's discords as well as his harmony. Hope means patience. Do you notice the inverted order of the last verse, 31? Those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. You know, if I was the poet, I'd have put that trio the other way around, wouldn't you? Building up to the climax. I mean, flying like an eagle's far more dramatic than walking and not fainting, isn't it? Ah, but that's the point, you see. That's the point. In the tragedies of life, it is not the wings of an eagle we so often need, but the dogged endurance of the long-distance walker. Flights of spiritual exhilaration are no use at all if they are followed immediately by dark plunges into depression. It is to walk and not faint when life is tough and incomprehensible. That's what we really need. And that is the strength which the God of all strength provides for his people, says Apollos. So here is a message of comfort. Comfort to a people on the verge of despair. Despair, I suspect, most of us can barely glimmer to imagine. Maybe those parents in Abba Farm 28 years ago imagine it a little bit better than we can. Here is a God who is big enough not only to share our joys, but our tragedies. And I tell you, it does work. See, it worked for these Jews in Babylon. Against all the odds, their faith survived. It worked for the early Christians. Against all the odds, they endured those lions in the Roman arena and built a faith for an empire. It worked for Jesus. He endured the cross and did not faint. Maybe for just a few of us here this evening, this is especially important. Mercifully, we don't always have to be passing through tragedies and trials of one sort or another, do we? Mercifully, there's a great deal of pleasure and joy and positive experience in our lives. Thank God there is. But usually, in a company of people this size, there are one or two who are privately weeping. Maybe for you, the temptation to doubt is very strong at the moment. Not doubt God's abstract existence. Doubt his care for you. Some bitterness, some personal tragedy, some resentment, some pain that is clouding your confidence in God's goodness and his love, making it hard for you to pray, making it hard for you to sing brave songs. It will work for you. There is light at the end of the tunnel. You want to find it? Then stop complaining that God has forgotten you. And yield to the prophet's advice. Fill your mind with the grandeur and majesty of God. This very night, this huge God is saying to your heart tenderly, let's pray together.